chanting horrible things. And so there is, you know, people were kind of fighting it out. But it seemed to have been instigated by these hooligans. They're known to be these rabid, you know, there's certain soccer fans in the world who are particularly known, and these Maccabee fans are known to be sometimes violent. Anyway, just wanted to throw that out there. If you hadn't heard that, it's important.
Right. Well, the important part of the story.
We
got
to go.
Okay.
So sorry, I put that out there, and I wanted to hear your take.
No worries.
Anyway, we could talk about it next month. Thank you so much, Abby Martin. It's been wonderful. First official program.
Yeah. Thank you so much for everyone who called in. Looking forward to next month.
All right. Thanks for supporting KBOO. Bye, everybody.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 9 a.m.
This is Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Become a member of KBOO today by texting KBOO to the phone number 44321. Now stay tuned for more community-powered radio.
Hi, this is Kendall Boyson, professional life and recovery coach, and you're listening to Encouragementology, the practice of instilling hope.
Hi there.
Thanks for joining me. On this show, we are building, belonging, and blooming together as we explore and celebrate the value of community. When you think of the word community, what comes to mind? Is it a neighborhood, a friend group, or maybe something you long for but haven't found yet? Even the self-proclaimed loner still needs to feel connected and supported. People need people. The popular song sheds some valuable insight. We're children needing other children, and yet letting a grown-up pride hide all the need inside. So let's talk about community. The people who lift you up, laugh at your bad jokes, and sometimes even remind you to take down your trash. Community isn't just a nice to have. It's a life-changing, soul-nourishing, growth-accelerating gift. Whether it's your ride-or-die crew, a group of neighbors, or a virtual squad cheering you from afar, we all need a tribe. Don't have one? No problem. You can start your own. It's easier than you think and way more fun than going it alone. In this episode, we'll explore why community matters, how to spot a good one or a bad one, and how finding your people can help you truly bloom. Because life's too short to be lonely. Let's build something beautiful together. Let's kick it off with the facts. Community and sense of belonging is important, dare I say critical, but don't just take it from me. There are clear mental health benefits. Strong relationships can act as a buffer against stress and mental health challenges. Harvard studies suggest that loneliness triggers a chronic stress response, increasing levels of stress hormones and inflammation, which can wear down the body over time. Having at least one dependable relationship helps combat this, fostering a sense of safety and support. It increases longevity. A meta-analysis of 148 studies by Dr. Holt Lundstedt revealed that strong social connections increase survival rates by 50%. Loneliness, on the other hand,
has been equated to health risks comparable to smoking 15 cigarettes a day or being obese. It definitely adds to happiness. The Harvard Study of Adult Development, a decades-long research project, found that the quality of our relationships is one of the strongest predictors of happiness. Small daily interactions like friendly chats with coworkers or neighbors also contribute to well-being. Social connections, whether with close family or casual acquaintances, create a web of support that enriches life. And there are broader impacts. Social isolation can have economic repercussions, like a reduced productivity and increased healthcare costs. For instance, loneliness among older adults adds an estimated $6.7 billion in Medicare spending. Addressing social disconnection has societal benefits, including improved public health, safety, and resilience. Take a look around. Okay, maybe not right at this moment, but throughout your week or month, where is your community? How much are you investing in your community? What's your ROI? Jenny Anderson shares some advice on the only metric of success that really matters is the one we ignore, found on Quartz. On a blustery March day 5 years ago, I locked arms with my mother and walked into a church in Maplewood, New Jersey, to bury my brother. Bagpipes played Amazing Grace. I remember shivering and worrying that my dad would slip, my mom would collapse, and I would botch the eulogy. The church was packed. My brother's four daughters looked empty, absent, all eyes on them, no escape from the hell that was that moment. His wife's pain and fear were palpable. When I stood up on the lectern and saw several hundred people, all of whom seemed to actually know my brother, I was humbled by the life he had created. He had designed exactly the life he wanted, running his own architecture firm in New York City, parenting four girls, belonging to a community that he had helped build literally by designing houses and figuratively by coaching lacrosse, talking to neighbors in the yard and strangers at the grocery store, and attending approximately 2 million children's birthday parties. In seeing his community, I became acutely aware of the feeling that I did not have my own. I had friends and a loving family, but as Annie Dillard wrote, how we spend our day is, of course, how we spend our lives. And I spent my days focused on optimizing myself, endless working and improving on a permanent quest to do as much as possible in the unforgiving confines of 24 hours. It was the only way I knew how to be. Compete, excel, win. I had never considered there might be a cost to a life of high-octane, high-reward competition. It's no secret that aging helps with perspective. Bill Gates, reflecting on his work last year, said that as a young man in his 20s, he was consumed with making Microsoft a personal computing giant. Today, his focus is on other people. Did I devote enough time to my family? Did I learn enough new things? Did I develop new friendships and deepen old ones? These would have been laughable to me when I was 25, but as I get older, they're much more meaningful. Before Robbie got sick, if you asked me if community mattered, I would have said yes, but I wouldn't have thought about it much. Nor would I have spent much time working out what it meant. But after many nights in emergency rooms and two long stays in hospitals, of watching my nieces slowly lose their father, I got a glimpse of what community looks like. It was the people who turned up before they were asked to do the things they didn't have to do. Neighbors who collected kids from school and came to the hospitals to sit. Friends who stayed. Groups of people who materialized to make lunch for four kids for months because their parents couldn't. This was community. What I would come to learn, slowly, is that community is about a series of small choices and everyday actions. How to spend a Saturday, what to do when a neighbor falls ill, how to make time when there is none. Knowing others and being known, investing in somewhere instead of trying to be everywhere. Communities are built like Legos, one brick at a time. There is no hack. When Robbie died, I wanted to do less and be more. And what I wanted to be was more connected, not only to my family and close friends, but to the people around me who would be the buffer against the inevitable absence of me. Thanks to Facebook and Instagram, many of us are still nominally in touch with our high school friends and coworkers from several jobs ago. But in our daily lives, communities are shrinking. From 1985 to 2009, the average size of an American social network, defined by the number of confidence people feel they have, has declined by more than one-third. We may have hundreds of friends on Instagram, but evidence is mounting that those connections are not the ones that provide us the social balm we need, which is human contact. Instead, the more connected we become, the more we seem to let our social relationships atrophy. Failing to catch up with an old friend, invite a neighbor over for coffee, or engage in some of life's basic daily rituals. Talking with someone on the way to work, getting coffee from a cafe where you know the barista's name, which soothe our social needs. Humans need others to survive, says Juliana Holt Lundstedt, a professor of psychology at Brigham Young University. Regardless of one's sex, country, or culture of origin, or age, or economic background, social connection is crucial to human development, health, and survival. In 2010, Holt Lundstedt published research showing that people who had weaker social ties had a 50% increased likelihood of dying early than those with stronger ones. Being disconnected, she showed, posed a danger comparable to smoking 15 cigarettes a day and was more predictive of early death than the effects of air pollution or physical inactivity. You can have friends and family and still feel deprived of community. John Cacioppo, who died last year, pioneered the field of social neuroscience and dedicated more than two decades to studying loneliness. He explained how misunderstood it could be, associated with social isolation, depression, introversion, and poor social skills, when in fact, it doesn't discriminate by income or class, ethnicity or gender. It is everywhere. Indeed, anyone living in a big city knows this to be true. You can have 100 friends and feel lonely. As Matthew Brashears, who conducted social network research at the University of South Carolina, says, the problem isn't, are you socially isolated, i.e., you have no social contact? The question is, are you experiencing social poverty or inadequate social support? For both the young and the old, the rich and the poor, the answer seems to be yes. When the BBC conducted a recent loneliness survey asking 55,000 people about their relationships, they found adults between the ages of 16 and 24 were the loneliest, with 40% responding that they felt lonely often or very often. Meanwhile, 27% of those over the age of 75 had the same response. The problem can also be cut across cultures. When the Kaiser Family Foundation surveyed rich countries with The Economist in 2018, it found that 9% of adults in Japan, 22% in America, and 23% in Britain always or often felt lonely, lacked companionship, or felt left out or isolated. People crave a sense of belonging, and yet we focus on how to look better, exercise efficiently, and work effectively, often neglecting to take the necessary steps to build and sustain social ties. Choices have consequences. My brother and his wife moved from New York City's Upper West Side to a suburb in New Jersey soon before the second of their four children was born. I pitied them. The commute, the strip malls, the numbing sameness of it all. My brother, then an architect for a big-name firm, saw what I was seeing. "You think it's soul death. It's not," he'd tell me when I would take the train from the city on the weekends. He extolled the virtues of space, the yard where the kids could play, the trampoline they could jump on, the strollers that could be left outside. People stopped by to chat or drop off their kids. He had neighbors. They knew the names of one another's children and the weird things each one of them was afraid of, like spiders or jelly or being barefoot. One boring birthday party at a time, he celebrated the seemingly unexceptionality of it all. I loved venturing out of the train onto Maplewood Avenue, especially in the fall with the leaves, electric reds and yellows everywhere, or in winter, where the snow didn't disintegrate to black slush. But for the most part, the whole thing held zero appeal to me. My husband and I were raising our kids in New York City. We took them to Mo Williams book signings and Laura Berkner concerts and explored the High Line with babies in tow. We were happy, building our busy lives, welcoming one and then two kids, trying to form the ties that bind. But on those walks on the High Line, surrounded by early morning runners, polished traders, bankers, consultants, actors, and fashionistas, I craved mediocrity. Where were the haggard humans, the people who walk around in sweatpants and not $100 Lululemon leggings? Where were those too tired to brush their hair, who felt they were failing on all fronts? All I could see were people striving to improve. I'm sure many wanted to move beyond their bubbles. Many probably did. But mostly, it seemed everyone was busy with being a player in a high-stakes game. Though I didn't understand it at the time, I was lonely. I didn't think it possible. I had friends. I had kids. I had no time. How could I be lonely? Loneliness researcher Capocho found that many of the things we think will help, improving people's social skills or increasing social engagement, don't. What does help lonely people is to educate them about how our brains can turn in on ourselves, causing us to retreat into self-preservation mode and be on high alert for social threats. This naturally makes people engage less and feel even more lonely, creating a vicious cycle. He found that learning how to connect required rebuilding certain physical muscles, including learning or relearning social cues, including tone of voice, eye contact, and posture. It's also necessary to give to others so that they will in turn give to us. As Cachopo explained, this can feel hard. It requires being vulnerable at a moment when one feels uniquely unsuited to do that. That's why it's not enough to get help or have a therapist, although these are certainly important. We need mutual aided protection. If you are only receiving aid and protection from others, that doesn't satisfy this deeper sense of belonging. This idea is backed up by research from Julia M. Rohrer, a PhD candidate at the Max Planck Institute, who studied a large group of Germans who said they were committed to trying to become happier. The twist was that some pursued self-improvement goals, like getting a new job or making more money, while others tried spending more time with friends and family. A year later, she found those who focused on connecting more with others were happier than those who pursued self-improvement. Our results demonstrate that not all pursuits of happiness are equally successful and corroborate the great importance of social relationships for human well-being. The thing that makes us happiest in life is other people, and yet other people are often the first thing to fall off of our lists of priorities. On one frigid series of New York City nights, I slept on a small cot in the ICU with my brother. He had had 30 pounds of tumors, and in an effort to stop the relentless march of cancer, doctors amputated his leg at the hip where the tumors were concentrated. He was opposed to this surgery. At moments, convinced he would recover and be able to run, his doctor finally told him he could not survive if he did not literally cut out the cancer. "Do you think I should do it?" he asked me desperately one night on the phone. I assured him it would be fine, though I was not at all sure it would be. How had it come to this? Later, I called him to update him on the state-of-the-art prosthetics. I could hear the defeat in his voice. "That will not be me," he said matter-of-factly. I flew to New York for the surgery. When I arrived, he was in intensive care and in a lot of pain. When the nurses changed his dressing, he would cry for them to stop. This from a man who never admitted pain before, a once bear of a human who could carry two 40-pound kids down a beach on a blazing hot day. He was proud and would ask me to leave when they came to tend to his wounds. I remember sitting right outside his door, resting my head on a desk, winded by the sight of him. No leg, so many tubes and machines. One of his nurses squatted by me, took my hand and looked at me. "He is so lucky to have you." "Why?" I sobbed, knowing it was a strange question for someone who saw pain all day long. "I don't know," he said genuinely, hugging me tightly. Late one night around 10 p.m., a friend came by. She brought me a meal. We talked about her startup. She mentioned her own mother's death. It felt like it would never be normal again. Eventually, it was. Not normal, but it was okay. When she left, disappearing into a bitterly cold night, I could breathe again. The nurse, the friend, they gave me something Facebook and Instagram could not. We moved to London amidst my brother's illness. I felt alone, vulnerable, and angry. I was furious at half of my friends for failing to grasp the hell we were living through. But through the fog of grief and over time, I took what I learned from my brother and started to build what I needed. When I returned to London after his funeral, I leaned on one friend. I retreated into my family. I took up piano, and in my piano teacher, I found a gentle soul whose priorities seemed so clear that I could start to remake my own. The power of quiet. The reward of learning. The catharsis of music and solitude. My pain unfolded, but not quite so aggressively. We moved into a new house and I introduced myself to my neighbors. I decided to act as if we were staying there forever, even though I had no idea how long we would be staying. I could no longer afford to always be looking ahead to the next place, job, or project. On Saturday afternoon at my mother-in-law's house in the countryside for my daughter's birthdays, I got a call from my New York Times editor who needed a story. I left the party and wrote it. A few minutes later, I quit the Times. I did not want to miss another birthday party. Over time, we found our people. On my daughter's 10th birthday, we had dinner at an Italian cafe on a street owned by a trio of forever bickering brothers. They welcomed us with hugs. We shared the meal with family and friends. At the end of the evening, I saw my friend whispering to Ella. She beamed. I later asked what she said. She told me that I could tell her anything, that she would always be there for me. Ella said, grinning at the thought of it, "Even stuff I don't tell you." My friend would be there for her. Community. Last Christmas, we moved back home after a stint away due to construction. The house was a mess. Christmas was looming, and I had deadlines to meet at work. I needed to get presents for our gigantic extended family. In the dust and the chaos, I literally could not breathe. I ended up in the hospital with an ulcer. When I was released at 6 a.m., a friend came to get me. She found the 24-hour pharmacy, got my medicine, brought me to her home, fed me, and put me to bed. The next night, I tried to go home, but could not sleep again. In the middle of the night, I turned up at a different friend's house. She too put me into bed. In the morning, she served me soup. "When did you make this?" I asked. "I made it yesterday," she said, "just in case you needed it." A few weeks later, I flew back from New York to find my husband in bed with a raging fever and no kids. "Where are the girls?" I asked. "Sleeping at Sam and Kate's," he said, "a few doors down." I used to think that community was as simple as having friends who bring lasagna when things fall apart and champagne when things go well, who pick up your kids from school when you can't. But I think community is also an insurance policy against life's cruelty, a kind of immunity against loss and disappointment and rage. My community will be here for my family if I cannot be. And if I die, my kids will be surrounded by people who know and love them, quirks and warts and oddities and all. In future-proofing my life, I have made every day richer. At school, my kids learned, a problem shared is a problem halved. Communities do that too. I arrived in my version of the soulless suburbs, and it turns out they're not soulless at all. Warren Buffett, a friend of Gates, says that his measure of success comes down to one question. Do the people you care about love you back? "I think that's about as good a metric as you can find," wrote Gates. I'd concur. Keep connecting with people, and in time, you will have a community. I am guilty. I mean, I am connected, and some would say I know everyone and have never met a stranger. All true. But what I do identify with is more time working and less time experiencing. I'm proud of my career and the outlets I've built, but there is a part of me that thinks, what have I missed? What quality time did I give up focusing on getting somewhere in my career? No time for shame, and if that resonates with you, no judgment. Remember, this is a journey, and once we reach a destination of revelation, we have an opportunity to grow and do better. Where do you want to do better? Seek out groups aligned with your interests, where people share goals of positivity, they support each other, and they offer mutual respect. Consider starting your own community with values you prioritize, like open communication and collaboration. You don't have to be a life coach, a counselor, or a therapist to start a support group. And disclaimer here, there doesn't have to be anything wrong with you to go to a support group. If you crave connection, understanding, and a chance to share, find a space, set a purpose, and let people know. Then Stay with it. People need time to make decisions and the courage to try something new. One post and one event won't be enough. Just stay consistent. I actually started my first support group before I was ever certified as a coach. I just created the right space, got people together, and encouraged conversation. I still do that today. I say I'm a fire starter. I just create the right environment for the spark to catch fire. Now I will step back, I'll encourage, I might get us back on track if we fall off, or I might encourage someone that's a little bit shy. But I let the group do the work, and it's in there. They want to be together, they want to share, and they want to grow. Take a leap of faith and try your own. If you want to share encouragementology with a friend who needs to know they're not alone in this journey of self-discovery, you can visit encouragementology.com or anywhere you stream your content to receive this episode and all others. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram for additional encouragement throughout the week. So I challenge you, step into the power of community by surrounding yourself with people who inspire, challenge, and uplift you. Because the connections you nurture today will shape your happiness, health, and purpose tomorrow. I know you can do it. Thank you for listening to Encouragementology with Kendall Boyson, where we find positive ways to handle some of life's challenges.
I stumbled through until the path was clear. That's when I found you.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Tower, KBOO 90.7. Dasha T said that.
Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production from independent community media. We bring local stories to a global audience, produced at a different location every week. I'm Ursula Rudenberg from Pacifica Network. Today on Sprouts, we report from Pacifica Network reporters from across the country who worked with us to describe some of the things that happened in their states on election night and some of the feelings and reasons behind these events. We start with the younger end of the voter spectrum, going to Western Washington University in Bellingham, Washington.
My name is Flynn Rodriguez, and I'm the public affairs producer at KUGS-FM Bellingham, Washington, up on the northern border. And here in Washington, many voters are overwhelmingly voting in favor of Kamala Harris, which is unsurprising, given the history of us as a blue state. The Senate looks like it's going to Cantwell, and the governor to Bob Ferguson once again. Bob Ferguson is with the Democratic Party, and Maria Cantwell is also with the Democratic Party as well. I have some things to say about the general influences on how Bellingham voters are feeling about the presidential election. I'd say that the general sentiment here is that there's hope for a Harris win, but there isn't a rallying support for her, and more so a desire to just not see another 4 years of Trump in office. And neither Trump nor Harris are giving many young voters what they really want, which is a United States call for ceasefire in Gaza and the immediate halt of all weapons and military funding sent to Israel. Neither candidate will condemn the genocide of the Palestinian people, and their continued stance of allyship with Israel is very much being seen as a blatant endorsement of this ongoing atrocity. Many here feel that Harris's democratic values are coming off as very performative, as she takes a stance as someone who is for the young voter and for the marginalized, but continues to stand behind Israel, which seems to be a very clear display of her unwillingness to really listen to young people, which I have heard from many around me has left them feeling gross and frustrated with the options given us this election. And as for Bellingham's cultural identity, which I would say ripples out to most of the West Coast of Washington, we are very liberal and very left-leaning here, and our city council unanimously called for a ceasefire in Gaza in December of last year, so it's a feeling that's shared generationally. There was an encampment on Western Washington University's campus this spring in support of Palestine. That momentum has not gone away at all. And Bellingham has seen a huge movement in community action to put pressure on our local government and our university administration to act for the people they represent. And Bellingham has also seen a fostering of community of people coming together in our grief and our anger to embody a way of being that leans on our family and friends and neighbors through mutual aid and community spaces that are acknowledging our raw human vulnerability now more than ever. And I'd say that that's something that no ballot could ever fully represent. So we're hoping for the safety that a democratic win could provide for us as we continue to navigate what it looks like to ensure that our voices are listened to. And we also have a overwhelmingly large queer community here. And I think that there's a lot of fear around the anti-trans rhetoric that Trump has been running his campaign on. And same goes for the abortion laws that are being put under scrutiny. And many of us are just scared about what 4 years could look like under Trump. And for many of us young student voters, it's our first time filling out a ballot, and it's a bleak introduction to adulthood. So it's somber and tense as we all await the results. A big measure that's on the ballot in Washington this year is 2117, which would prohibit state agencies from imposing any type of carbon tax credit trading and repeal legislation, establishing a cap and invest program to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. It would decrease funding for investments in transportation, clean air, renewable energy, conservation, and emissions reduction. Many people here feel that the inaction of this measure would be truly just catastrophic for the environment and a huge hit to the progress that has been made towards environmental restoration and conservation. Everything is really at risk here. Our clean air, water, soil. It would dramatically affect indigenous communities by getting rid of really important project funding and putting more pressure on already stressed communities and systems. And overall, many Washingtonians are just adamantly against this measure and see no benefit in it and are really outraged that it's being proposed at all in a state that benefits and loves its land so much. So there's been a lot of rallying for voting no on 2117. Measure 2066 also falls under this category of prohibition of certain laws and regulations around natural gas use. And it just generally feels like a huge step backwards in these environmental advocacy spaces and just for humanity's well-being as a whole. So that's what's on all of our minds, is autonomy and the environment. So it is anxious in Bellingham tonight. My name is Flynn Rodriguez, and I'm the public affairs producer at KUGS FM Bellingham, Washington, up on the northern border. Thank you.
As part of Pacifica Network's election night coverage, Dr. Julian Malveau of WPFW in Washington, D.C., spoke with election campaigners in southern Georgia about rural voters.
And so we have Marion Gaines Jones, lead organizer with the Southwest Georgia Education and Voter Registration Campaign. You know, we always think about Atlanta and Augusta, the big cities, but you've been focusing on some of the rural areas. What are we missing when we focus on the big cities and not the rural areas?
Well, you're missing those votes, you know.
There you go.
First, you're missing those votes. Most people in rural counties do vote. And that's what I was seeing on my tips, that they're actually getting out to the polls, the young, the olders, and the in between, that 35, 17 and a half, 35 age range that we've been targeting. So it's been a great turnout in all of the counties that I visited in Canada.
Well, you know, Marion, what do rural people care about that we urban people don't pay attention to? Give me one issue that they care about more than we do.
I'm so glad you asked that question. The cost of living is a big issue. Just being able to survive, that's an issue in rural counties in Georgia. What we realize is that most of those persons that are working, most of them may not be high school or college graduates.
Mm.
So when you look at the income ratio, still have minimum wage jobs here. and particularly in rural counties where they're building all of those Dollar Trees, dollar stores, you know they don't pay any money. And we're talking about custodians, bus drivers, who are always underpaid, but their services are so valuable.
The cost of living is a big thing for rural folks because basically they don't have the employment opportunities that others do. Marion, you have been such a wonderful resource. Marion Gaines Jones, joining from Georgia, organizer. Thank you so very much for being with me.
Thank you for having me.
That was Julianne Malveaux of WPFW in Washington, D.C., reporting on voting politics in Georgia. In Sarasota, WSLR reports on the historic moment when Florida, a swing state, stopped swinging.
I'm Johannes Werner. I'm news director at WSLR 96.5 FM in Sarasota, Florida. We just reemerged from a landslide here. Florida is solidly in the Trump camp. The preliminary statewide count shows 56% for Trump. Florida does not look at all like a swing state anymore. Republican candidates won up and down Miami-Dade County, and that used to be a Democratic stronghold. There was very high turnout in early voting, possibly record-setting turnout. Lines were really long in the past weeks here, and it's obvious the Republicans have caught up and beat Democrats in what used to be their ground game. In early in-person voting, Republicans exceeded Democrats by a million this time, and that's a complete shift. I think it's mostly due to culture war and the successful waging of culture wars. I think it's a function of culture wars. The Republicans have successfully positioned themselves as warriors on issues that are quite popular here. They framed, for example, school board races in terms of parental rights. We're the most extremist county here, I would say, in Florida. That's Sarasota County. This is where a lot of these extreme ideas have been hatched. There's beginning to be a pushback here. And amazingly, two moderate candidates were elected to that school board in the primaries this summer, in the non-party elections this summer. The Florida Democrats' best hopes just before the election was to break the Republican supermajority in the state legislature, which has made possible an avalanche of conservative laws in the past legislative session, but it doesn't look at all like this is going to happen. The biggest disappointment for activists here are the constitutional amendments. That's the citizen-initiated Amendment 3, which would have legalized recreational use of marijuana. And then there's Amendment 4, which would have anchored the right to access abortion in the Florida Constitution. There was a lot of energy and they mobilized a lot of young people. The petition gatherers easily exceeded the signatures they needed, and both amendment campaigns have raised more than $100 million each. But in response, Governor Ron DeSantis has blatantly used taxpayer funds and the state's institutions to campaign against both. And the outcome is both amendments got majorities, but the marijuana amendment has clearly fallen short of the 60% they needed at 55.75%. And the abortion amendment landed at 57%. There is some progressive energy in the state. There were two interesting races for state attorney in the Orlando and Tampa Bay area. Both Monique Worrell and Andrew Warren had been fired by Governor Ron DeSantis, and they were both running to get their jobs back. And Monique Worrell actually won. She managed that with a whopping 57%. She is in Orlando, and Orlando is kind of a counter story to Miami-Dade. And that story is driven by progressive candidates. There is U.S. Representative Maxwell Frost, who cruised to re-election with 62% of the vote. And then there is Anna Escamani. She's a progressive leader in the Florida House. She easily won re-election with 58%. One of the observations I would like to add here is the issues here for working people. Florida is a low-wage, mean state. Life is really tough for working people. The legislature has passed extreme anti-labor laws recently, but there is pushback now. Teamsters have celebrated major organizing victories in Florida this year, particularly in our neck of the woods here in Southwest Florida. UPS workers in this region were picketing this summer. Even bank tellers here are unionizing right now, as are Starbucks baristas. And that's quite a big deal in this low-wage service economy here. The biggest deal, though, is the pushback by teachers' unions. They were the main political target of all this anti-union legislation. They now have to get 60% of eligible workers to vote for a union if they want to recertify. But the teachers' unions managed to do that with flying colors this year. So most of the recertifying votes in this region and in some of the biggest school districts in Florida was above 80%. How that newly found energy translates into electoral politics all remains to be seen. And then there's the issue of overdevelopment. That's how it's defined here. The sprawling suburbs and big hotels and luxury condos that get built are the biggest concern of residents in this area. It's creating conflict within Republican strongholds here in Southwest Florida. There's the case of Manatee County, where the MAGA base, for instance, just flushed out a complete set of county commissioners they had just elected in the last cycle, and it's all over development and overdevelopment. And that mixes with three hurricanes that hit this area recently, plus two major flooding events. So climate change is, whether Republicans call it that way or not, seeping into Republican politics here. And the overdevelopment fears are tied into fears of flooding now and anxiety over disappearing agriculture and food security. So that's an interesting development we're watching very closely here. Johannes Werner, news director at WSLR 96.5 FM in Sarasota, Florida.
In West Virginia, not a lot of surprises, although a lawsuit over ballot integrity is in development in Mingo County.
Hello, I'm Roy Clark from WEFR in Fairmont, West Virginia. Some projections here from the Associated Press. Republican Donald Trump is projected to win West Virginia, and for the U.S. Senate seat of retiring Joe Manchin, Republican Jim Justice, the current governor of West Virginia, is projected to win. And for the U.S. House districts in District 1, Riley Moore, Republican, is expected to win. In West Virginia District 2, Carol Miller, the incumbent Republican House representative. And the AP also projects that Republican Patrick Morrissey will also be the next governor of West Virginia. Those are all the major federal and state races in West Virginia. It's been a pretty peaceful day as far as elections in West Virginia as is concerned. It's running like a well-oiled machine, someone from the Secretary of State's office said earlier today. I haven't heard of any major discrepancies or anything. The turnout in West Virginia was higher than average for West Virginia. And looking at some of the percentages here for the president, 62%. That's quite a bit. Still kind of wondering about that 6th district state senate race down there in Mingo County, which is quite unusual, where there is now a lawsuit that has been filed by the ACLU over ballot integrity, and the candidate that's qualified to run was left off the ballot for 5 days of early voting. So the qualified Democrat candidate was left off the ballot for the state senator's race in District 6. But the Republicans in that county outnumber the Democrats in Mingo County by 1,700. That makes you wonder. It's going to be interesting to watch that one play out. I'm Roy Clark, WEFR AM 1700 in Fairmont, West Virginia.
Welfare for the wealthy, debt, war, corruption, treason, and season on human rights.
You're listening to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of global interest. Today on Sprouts, Pacifica Network reporters from around the country describing some of the things that happened in their states on election night and some of the feelings and reasons behind them. We heard from Washington State, Washington, D.C., Georgia, Florida, and West Virginia. In Concord, New Hampshire, WNHN, monitors voting day problems and credits poll workers for their steadfast commitment.
I'm Brian Beal, host and producer of the American Democracy Minute, a daily news report on democracy issues from WNHN in Concord, New Hampshire. Credit the few number of problems November 5th to our hero election officials and poll workers, who, despite 4 years of threats and harassment, made sure our election was safe and secure, like they always have. We chronicled the biggest issues in our November 8th report. State and federal election officials term most problems encountered in the November 5th presidential election as routine, with quickly discredited bomb threats and ballot shortages among the worst issues of the day. The hoax bomb threats, which the FBI quickly traced to a Russian domain, briefly affected some precincts in Georgia, Pennsylvania, Arizona, Michigan, and Wisconsin. Most locations were operational in less than an hour. In Fulton County, Georgia, 32 precincts received threats, according to the Associated Press. In Cumbria County, Pennsylvania, a ballot printing issue prevented reading by the optical scanners, according to the New York Post. Working ballots arrived by 1:15 and were used for the remainder of the day. Polling hours were extended due to the problem. In Boston, WBUR reports that the Massachusetts Secretary of State is investigating ballot shortages in 5 to 10 precincts. The state had provided adequate ballots, but apparently city election officials didn't distribute all that was allocated to the precincts and didn't answer the phone when the calls came in for more. In Milwaukee, access panels to power and USB ports on some optical ballot readers were unsecured when over 30,000 of the over 106,000 absentee ballots were tabulated, according to VoteBeat. The panels were secured, the machines reset, and the affected ballots were rerun. You'll note we didn't mention widespread voter fraud in our November 8th report. There wasn't any this year or in 2020, thanks again to the professionalism of the nation's poll workers. Reporting for Sprouts and the Pacifica Radio Network, I'm Brian Beal.
In Texas, Jim Ellinger gives figures for election night, including the much-touted Senate race between Colin Allred and Ted Cruz.
Good evening. This is Jim Ellinger with Austin Airways, reporting from the historic Driscoll Inn in downtown Austin, Texas. It was a sour evening for Texas Democrats. They had hoped that Ted Cruz, sometimes described as the most hated man in the United States Senate, and many people remember him taking a vacation in Cancun as Texas suffered the worst ice storm in a generation, leaving 200-plus Texans dead. Ted Cruz has been reelected rather handily against Colin Allred, former U.S. congressman and Texas football star, only did so-so, not as well as the skateboarding Beto O'Rourke of a few years ago. Again, Colin Allred, had he won, could have changed the United States Senate from Republican to Democrat. A well-known and very progressive Austin area congressman, Lloyd Doggett and Greg Kassar, won their reelections handily. In the city of Austin, where housing had become a growing issue, incumbent Mayor Kirk Watson, who had raised $1 million, rather handily beat all of his five opponents and avoided a runoff by pulling more than 50% of the vote. Perhaps not surprising, in Texas, NBC and MSNBC called Texas for Trump very early on, and District Attorney Jose Garza, a very progressive man who had battled with the Austin Police Department and their many recalcitrant officers, won by more than 70% and showed strong support for reining in the Austin Police Department. All in all, it was a sour evening for Texas Democrats.
That was Jim Ellinger reporting from Austin, Texas. Another report from Texas concerns a judiciary race in the Houston area that has national implications about election funding. Daniel J. Cohen reported this to Pacifica's Houston station, KPFT. Cohen is with an advocacy group called Indivisible Houston. They describe themselves as a coalition to fight the rise of tyranny in America. He's speaking with KPFT's host, Egberto Willis.
There's this pact called Stop Houston Murders, and it's propped up by large, wealthy donors, but its single largest donor, they gave it $650,000 out of the $2 to $3 million of its raid estimated based on what it spent through Election Day. Also, raises a lot of money based off of these billionaires and household names. So that pact, the Judicial Fairness Pact, raised $8.3 million and spent $2.3 million. It's a little complicated, but actually, there was $1 million that was given by Kenneth Morris Kitcher. He's a billionaire financial guy. There's $1 million given by Hillwood Development. And then PRT Holdings, Apache Corporation, ConocoPhillips, Jeffrey Hildebrand, another billionaire, Chevron America, not to mention a bunch of other major corporations and major money people have given money to this PAC. And they run this narrative that says, stop Houston murders. And they run a completely false anti-scientific narrative on how the bond system actually works. But the thing is, as much as they run on defeating criminal judges, what they really are hoping happens is that people go and vote on judges, whether they're criminal or civil. Because all those corporations and companies that I just mentioned want to win their civil lawsuits so that they don't have to pay restitution to people who they poison and otherwise kill with their derelict duty, monopolistic corporate greed. So that's really what's going on. It's extremely sinister because if you think about it, the groups I just named, real estate, big finance, and big oil are getting involved in judicial races and using a false narrative on law and justice or justice and safety or whatever you want to call it so that they can win civil suits. So it's a really nasty trend and extremely corrosive to democracies. The most sophisticated version of the dark money scam that we've seen in maybe any election cycle so far. And they deploy it here in Harris County, and it was effective. We're going to see what happens. I do think a lot of Democratic judges are going to pull it out. So I think the ones that got attacked, probably a lot of them will survive. But a lot of these races are closer than they should have been. They probably aren't going to be effective enough in the DA's race, but it's closer than it should have been. And the Court of Appeals races look pretty tenuous in terms of what the outcomes are going to be. So it's been a rather effective and nasty and, frankly, evil and villainous tactic.
I'm looking down the list of races in the judiciary, and this is not just local to Houston or Harris County. This is something that is playing all over the country.
The way that funders have invested in elections, if those funders truly care about winning these races, then you can't just write $90 million in checks in $2,800 or $5,000 at a time to a candidate that's going to spend the majority of it on airtime and it's going to go up and slope for the rest of time when you could have taken literally a million of those dollars and probably bailed out a whole slate of judges. Or at least even if you had taken, you know, $2 or $3 million, let's say I'm wrong, you need more money. $2 or $3 million out of $90 million that gets spent on some of these big statewide races could have bailed a lot of these judges out. You're talking about a wide range of both criminal and civil cases that the Court of Appeal is going to rule on, which means whether or not women live or die based on whether or not they need an abortion, as well as workers' rights, as well as immigration cases, as well as big business cases, and whether or not they're allowed to poison the air and water. All of that is going to be decided by these Court of Appeals races across 10 counties. And it would have been worth peeling off just a small amount of that statewide money that goes basically up in smoke. There's no infrastructure left. It was all spent on big airtime plays. If you just hire organizers and you build long-lasting institutional movement-based work, then you can prevent a lot of these losses from happening. But I think that knowledge and education isn't really common in the U.S. at this point. We love to revere Martin Luther King. We only read one of his speeches. And then in addition to that, nobody learns how to do what he does. There's nowhere in your school that they teach you about power and political organizing. There are a lot of voters, particularly there's a lot of white guys, okay, I'm going to be direct, who voted for Obama, Trump, and then Biden. But I imagine some of them went back to Trump at least. So they flip and flop around. I don't think people are bad. I think people, by and large, are good. What I mean by that is when people saw families getting separated and they saw all of those ICE detention facilities, they didn't like it. Viscerally, they opposed it, but they couldn't imagine it, and they can't get their head around it as opposed to seeing them tangibly. And so when this guy says mass deportations, I think if those people really saw what that really means, that you kick down a fence in the middle of your buddy's barbecue while you're all watching NFL football and drag dad off to a facility and tear him away from his kid, I think that they would be horrified. But I think they can't crystallize what the actual outcome is going to be in their head. I think we'll see what happens at the national level, but I think to some degree that's happened when Roe was overturned. Some women finally threw out a lot of the other issues and said, okay, well, I'm just voting on that. Like, I can see it now. Now we're having women dying because they can't get access to care. It's real direct fear about someone who you know. The same way that when people's kids started coming out of the closet, then people's minds on gay marriage started to change. So I think that people vote against their own interests. And I think that the reason that that happens is if you are not extremely politically active, then you don't necessarily read the outcome before it's going to happen, because they can't understand how these things are going to impact their interests because they're not political.
Thank you so kindly for giving us your expertise here. And thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And that's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to Pacifica Network reporters across the country describing some of the things that happened in their states on election night and some of the feelings and reasons behind them. Our contributors this week include member stations KUGS in Bellingham, Washington, WPFW in Washington, D.C., WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WEFR in Fairmont, West Virginia, WNHN in Concord, New Hampshire, and KPFT in Houston, Texas. This week's Sprouts was produced by Lisa Loving, Ursula Rudenberg, and Stephanie Schubert. Music you heard included Wake Up America by Robert Wickline. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the globe, coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. I'm Ursula Rudenberg from Pacifica Network. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.
Listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
Goodbye.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for